On the Empire Podcast this week, we have a hat trick of interviews for your delectation and enjoyment. 1-0! It's Lee Child, creator of Jack Reacher and massive Aston Villa fan. And it's The Equalizer! Or more accurately, thanks Phil, or more accurately, the director of The Equalizer, Mr. Antoine Fuqua. And last but not least, ghosting past Mamadou Sakho and heading in a late winner at the near post because nobody was marking her, is the Gone Girl herself, Rosamund Pike. All that, and yet somehow there's even more movie news and nonsense to come on the only movie podcast that will never forget where it was when Jason Orange quit Take That. A moment of silence there for Jason Orange.
Yeah.
Where were you when Jason Orange quit Take That?
Asleep, not giving a shit. That's largely where I was and exactly what I was doing. Poor Jason Orange. First they take Orange Wednesdays from us, now they take Jason Orange from us.
Wow, can our oranges be far behind?
Absolutely not. Hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast. I'm joined this week by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. That's just for you, James Ward, who requested the return of that little description. Those two colleagues are the Robbie Williams of our gang, and by that I mean she's cheeky, fun loving, and has a personal fortune of over £90 million. It's Helen O'Hara.
I don't really.
Of course you do. You work for Empire. We're loaded.
Hey, I'm confused. Two colleagues of such lethal cunning. No.
Oh well, hello. It's a different podcast.
I'm confused. Two colleagues of such lethal cunning. That
it just stops in the film. It stops.
Oh,
Connery says three challengers of such lethal cunning, and then he just stops.
It doesn't make much sense.
Of such lethal cunning.
It upsets me.
I shudder that he remembered my Charlemagne. Anyway, let's welcome the Gary Barlow of our pod, and by that, of course, I mean he's a housewife's choice. He's well groomed. He's well turned out. He's massively into Czech expressionism. It's our art house guru, Phil DeSimone.
Yay.
How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks, Chris.
Do you ever get together with Gaz Barlow and talk about art house movies? I'm sure he's massively into it.
No.
No?
I haven't for a while. No, I used to.
Oh, love Three Colors Blue trilogy. It's brilliant.
Yeah, he would love Blue, the big Tory. Would.
Yeah, but he's also a Liverpool fan, so he might be drawn to the red. Okay. All right, you've been sending questions in via Facebook, via Twitter. We got a question from Facebook this week, which I'm very, very excited about. It's a long one, but yeah, we'll get there in a second. Anyway, at Ward_17, the same James Ward who requested the return of Such Lethal Cunning, asks, what's your favourite movie hat or similar headwear?
Well, that is the big important question that I think we've been remiss in not covering so far.
130 episodes in, I'm actually astonished we haven't got to this one.
Yes.
But, yeah.
It's such a tough question, isn't it? Because we all have, when you come right down to it, quite strong opinions on hats. I mean, probably the correct answer is just Indiana Jones fedora, which is pretty hard to beat in terms of its iconography.
I adore the fedora.
Who doesn't? I would also put in a word for the fruit hat in Copacabana, which I think has done more to spark fashion trends than most movie hats.
Are there any oranges on that fruit hat?
No, but
yeah,
Chris,
see?
No, but Chris, oranges are not the only fruit.
That's
are they?
True.
So yeah. There's other fruit. There's a huge pineapple.
The Indie Fedora is, I think, number one for me. Do you know that there was rumours a few years ago of this fourth Indiana Jones film, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull?
I had
this weird dream
it, yeah.
Where I was watching it, and at the end of the movie, Indy's fedora blows off his head, mm-hmm. and it drops on the ground, and that was a weird dream. Shia LaBeouf was playing Indiana Jones'
son. So weird.
I know. And he goes to pick it up, and as one, the entire cinema yells, "Don't you fucking touch that hat! You don't deserve to touch that hat!"
Yeah.
And then Indy takes it off him and puts it back in his head. The weird dream, very vivid.
And then you were dragged out of the cinema.
But surprisingly...
I threw my shoe at the cinema.
Surprisingly believable dream, that, yeah.
I know, weird.
That is a weird one. I've got one that's actually not very helpful at all because it's not in movies, but...
What?
Shall I go now? Frank.
Go on.
Frank, Judah Friedlander from 30 Rock, he always sports a great baseball cap.
Yeah.
With a variety of messages on it. Of alternative careers.
I love 30 Rock, but that character... Oh God! Don't even get me started. That's the only thing
like
that Judah.
Hat,
that's
though.
The only thing that justifies that character's existence
his
in
hat.
The show. His hats, which is something that Judah Friedlander does. In
it's
real
his
life.
Thing, right?
Yeah
he did
thing.
It before 30 Rock, didn't
yeah.
he? Every sort of different one for different in different languages, depending on where he was doing his stand up.
Yeah,
but
so every episode, yeah. Frank, the writer on the show, who somehow was in the credit sequence despite the fact that he was barely in every episode, or barely in any of the episodes, mm-hmm. because he was a rubbish character. His shtick is that he wears a different baseball cap with a different hilarious slogan on it every week.
He had an affair with Susan Sarandon in the show, didn't he? That just made no sense.
Did he?
When he was a kid. She been his teacher and seduced him or something. Am I
that's
making
right.
this up?
Yeah, 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 no, that's one of the few right. decent yeah. Frank episodes.
Yeah, that was quite yeah. good. I would also put in a good word for a couple more hats. It's quite fun, I think, to put dead animals on your head in movies. I don't recommend it in real life. But the bear hat in True Grit is impressive. And the lion hat, of course, in Hercules recently. Do we call it a hat? It's more of a full body cape. I don't know. For iconic lady hats, I would point out Rosalind Russell in His Girl Friday, who wears a fabulous hat. Mm-hmm. And Andy McDowell in Four Weddings, the gigantic satellite dish hat. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's necessarily good, but it does have a certain magic about it.
Love the sombreros, the lovely embroidered sombreros that Three Amigos wear.
Yeah.
Which we had to track down whenever we reunited them a couple of years ago. And it was, you know, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Martin Short's nephew had the original hats and brought at least one or maybe two of them along to the shoot, which was great. And they actually put the original hats on. That was a nice little touch. I wasn't there. This is like a third person recounting the story. And you talk about hats. You mentioned True Grit.
I did.
Which Nick asked us to mention as well. Johnny Depp in Lone Ranger.
Lone Ranger.
There's talking about the Miller's Crossing and the Coen brothers. The hat, of course. I think it's a Homburg in Miller's Crossing, which played such a huge part.
Every film noir had great hats. Frank Nitti in The Untouchables. Homburg, was it?
I don't know my hats, I'll be honest.
No.
I know fedora. Freddy Krueger wears a fedora as well, which is a really interesting choice.
And where does the Panama come into it? Like, it's really confusing.
And what about the Adjustment Bureau? Who could forget?
Oh, those were great
You'd
hats.
Forgotten.
No, I like that
movie.
But
that was a plot device, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. You had to wear the hat and go through a door.
To go through the door, like Mr. Ben.
Oh, love it.
Hugh Jackman's top hat in The Prestige actually plays a part of the plot.
Yeah,
very, very interesting. Lauren Hardy, bowler hats. Blues Brothers,
yep.
They wear hats.
They do.
Who else wears hats?
I mean, anything where Timothy Olyphant wears a cowboy hat, I'm pretty on board with.
Yeah.
Cowboy hats in general are pretty good.
Clint Eastwood, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Kurt Russell in The Thing. Creedy wears a big cowboy hat.
He does.
Yeah.
Oh, and Marge Gunderson with the sort of warm and woolly police hat.
Welcome to Hat Talk, your weekly guide to hats. Do you wear hats in real life? Do you wear a hat?
I look great in hats.
Yeah?
It's one of the very few items of clothing that doesn't look horrible on me.
See, that's the point where everyone's meant to go, no, Helen, no, you look
great.
I didn't
expect it.
What are you talking
really
about?
Didn't.
Yeah, what? You look great. Hats. I don't know. We know someone who wears a hat all the time, Kim Newman.
Yes.
Who wears it and pulls it off.
He wears it with panache.
He does. He does wear it with panache. Phil, you strike me as a sort of well-dressed, well-turned outfit. Not today, obviously. You let yourself go a bit. But, you know, do you wear a hat in your everyday life? Would you wear a hat?
I did wear a hat. Well, I went to Bolivia a long time ago, and I bought a hat, and I came back and I wore it at the airport in a poncho with a cheroot, and I think I had a pony. And my parents conspicuously pretended they didn't know who I was. So that was probably the last time I've worn an actual hat. But people don't really wear hats these days, do they? So
no, they don't.
You would look like you're making a statement straight away.
There's
which
a stand.
In Kim's case you can carry off, but in mine you probably couldn't.
It does feel weird. I mean, I do kind of... I wouldn't want to go back to the 60s because they wouldn't have internet or, you know, heat and things like that. But, you know, not the magazine, the thing that makes you hot. They didn't have it in the 60s, I checked.
Huh.
But yeah, it'd be great to go back because everyone wore a suit and was really dapper and had hats, and you could look like Don Draper and get away with it, and that'd be cool.
You could look like Don Draper and get away with it.
Yeah, but if you walked into the Empire office wearing like a 60s style suit and a hat, people would immediately go, "When's a job interview?" Or "Who's died?" Or "It, you know, are you going to a job interview to kill someone?" And you know, it's kind of those things. I mourn the loss of that period. Anyway, enough hat chat.
I think so.
We put the hat
more
in chat. Than. If you have any movie hats we've missed, again, this is all off the top of our heads. So do send them in to us via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. As some people have, they responded to last week's big topic, which was what our favourite movie slaps. There's still one I can't get in my head. I still can't quite figure out what it was. It's a lady slaps a man and then she immediately kisses him. Like, she's really distraught and she's crying. She goes, "Ah, you son of a bitch!" and slaps him. And then she goes, "Ah!" and they start kissing. Maybe it was One of my private movies. Like,
was that in Wonderful Dreams again?
It might have been. Who knows? Anyway, so at T. Ajayi said, Kurt Russell in Tombstone, you going to say something or are you going to stand there and bleed? It's a man slap with added glove.
Ooh.
Good slap. Anything that has Kurt Russell in it is good for us. Nathan Farrell at Nelly0777 says, another good slap is in Con Air. Nick Cage slapping, I believe his name is Renele Santiago. It's true, Nick Cage goes through the plane at the end. He goes on this rampage through the plane. He's punching people and kicking him out of his way. And then he gets to the film's most dubious character, which is the drag queen who's only there for comic relief. And then he slaps him out of the way rather than he's not manly enough to take a punch. So it's a little dubious. But
I'm not sure that would feature on my top list of movies.
Not on my
slaps,
top list either. No. Best movie slap, Empire Magazine. Bogey in Maltese Falcon. When you're slapped, you'll take it and you'll like it. That was Bogey.
Thanks for clarifying.
When you're slapped, you'll take it and you'll like it. Bogey obviously leads me to thought. Remember Casablanca when he talked to Peter Lorre? That was fun, wasn't it?
I don't even think about it.
And one I cannot believe that we missed out is in Chinatown.
Oh.
And many, many people were pointing that one out to us. Which is the great moment where, you know, Jack Nicholson keeps slapping Faye Dunaway. He's looking for the truth. Spoiler, put your spoiler helmet on. And she goes, she's my sister. Slap. She's my daughter. Slap. She's my sister. Slap. She's my daughter. Because the horrible truth is revealed. So, yeah. So we missed those out. If you think we've missed out any cracky movie hats, then do send them in. And we'll read them out in the show next week. Last question now from Andrew Young via email, who asks, across all three films, which do you think is the best performance in a Godfather film?
Three films?
Or have you had that strange recurring dream?
I've had
a
strange dream as well. There was a fourth one with Shia LaBeouf as the next generation of Corleone. What, do you know how many people were nominated? I didn't really realise quite how many people have been nominated for Oscars for acting roles in the Godfather trilogy. Andy Garcia in the last one. Mm-hmm. But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, so 8 different actors.
Which ones?
Brando, Jimmy Caan, Al Pacino twice, Robert Duvall, Robert De Niro, Lee Strasberg, Talia Shire, and Michael Gazzo, and then of course Andy Garcia.
So only Andy Garcia was nominated from Godfather 3?
Yes, from Godfather 3.
Whereas everyone was nominated from Godfather 1 and 2?
Every single person.
Yeah.
In both those movies. Apart from John Cazale, which is...
Yeah.
Surprising to me, because I think he's one of the standouts, if not the standout. Some of his scenes with Pacino are, well, that one particular scene where he disowns him is absolutely magnetic acting from both of them. Him.
Yeah, he was nominated.
Yeah, nominated for one Golden Globe.
This is an amazing thing. Phil's led us down a little rabbit hole here. John Cazale, 5 films, all of them greats. One of the truly great actors, was nominated for just one major award in his life, a Golden Globe at that, for Best Supporting Actor for Dog Day Afternoon. Otherwise, he was completely overlooked for both Godfathers, for The Deer Hunter. That's insane.
It is a bit insane. Yeah, yeah. It really
hashtag
is.
Hashtag justice for Cazale has started right here. John, not Joe, but yeah, but that's. Wow, that's weird. That is so weird. I'm angry now. I'm very angry. Yeah, he's amazing in the Godfather movies. Absolutely amazing. But the best performance, that's the question, the best performance all three Godfather films.
Surely it has to be Pacino, just because he has the most developed and the most complete arc of any character. And you know, he travels furthest of all of them. Not necessarily, literally, geographically
also,
speaking.
Also, we should do a Michael Corleone Air Miles map.
We should. That would be fun. But you know, he's the one who changes most completely, and whose, you know, evolution is chronicled throughout. So I don't know. It's pretty obvious, but that would be my choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then, do you go for that because he has the luxury of three films in which to carve out the character, or do you go for the
scene
flame
steamers
of Jimmy Caan, who burns so brightly and then gets snuffed out so memorably? It's, you know, who just owns that film for every moment that he's alive in The Godfather, and then when he's not alive, the film actually takes a noticeable dip in
oh my goodness, you just criticised something about The Godfather.
Yes, I did. Yes, I bloody well did. Yeah, alright, got a problem with that?
Yep.
You got a problem with that, the Italian mob? Oh shit. Yeah. It does, it dips for about 31 seconds, admittedly, but it takes a noticeable dip. And then the Michael story comes to the foreground again and everything's okay. But he is so energetic and so full of life in that film. I think there's a big loss when he goes. I love Duvall as Tom Hagen in both films. I think
he's good.
I think one of the great losses to The Godfather 3 was the fact he didn't come back. Mm. George Hamilton is not a good replacement.
I agree with that. He's very sort of, he's an unobtrusive presence, but absolutely underpins everything that's going on around him. Mm. And him and he, Duvall and Diane Keaton are the two kind of outsiders, aren't they? They have to portray a sense of sort of otherness within this mafia world. One of my favourite sort of sub-stories is Lee Strasberg.
Yes.
Who, of course, created The Method. And then, like your teacher just turning up to join in the five-a-side on the playground, sort of turns up and wins an Oscar nomination for Hyman Roth.
Yeah, he's amazing as Hyman Roth as well. Phil, do you agree with Pacino?
Yeah.
Pacino's the one, not Brando?
Pacino.
Pacino. Okay, thanks for your questions. As ever, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. You use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. Please Facebook us as well, as Benjamin Stevenson Hall did this week. We're on Facebook as, you'll never guess, Empire Magazine. And you can email us as well, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for the first of our three, count them three. Sorry, Ali. Interviews this week, we have authors in the pod every now and again, from Max Brooks to George R.R. Martin. And when we heard Lee Child, the British author who created the mighty Jack Reacher, was in town to promote the 19th Reacher novel, Personal, I jumped at the chance to have him in the pod booth and crossed our fingers in hope that, unlike his creation, he wouldn't say nothing. And he didn't. As you'll find out. Jim Grant was talking to James Dyer and myself, aka the office's Reacher fanatics. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Lee Child, the man who created Jack Reacher. How are you, sir?
Very well, thanks. Great to be here.
Excellent. Now, I called you Lee Child, but of course your real name is Jim Grant. I'm interested to know, how many people in your life actually call you Jim Grant?
Nobody calls me those names two together. I mean, I've got my some friends and my wife call me Jim. Mm-hmm. I suppose if the bank writes to me or the IRS actually would call me Mr. Grant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's outnumbered millions to one by the people that call me Lee Child.
At what point did it start becoming weird that people like James and myself would meet you and say, nice to meet you, Lee?
It's not weird at all. I mean, I've always had a very ambivalent relationship to names. You know, my so-called real name was given to me by two people that I didn't know at the time. And as I grew to know them, I didn't like them very much. So how is that my name any more than one I would give myself?
So if you had to, Lee Child was obviously your choice, but if you had to, say, for example, you had to change it again.
Well, I was in showbiz all my life in various ways, and for a long time contracted to one particular television company. So if I wanted to work anywhere else, then I would have to use a different name. And I think altogether I've probably worked under at least five, if not six names. Tony Jackson was my name for a while. Richard Strange was a name for a while. If you pore over sort of vague, you know, credits on various old DVDs or theater programs, you find these names, and that was me.
And are all these people essentially the same you, or do you change yourself to fit each name?
That's a great question, because I think we change anyway. As we get older and we develop, we do change a little bit. And in a way, yeah, you know, each name represents a part of the progression. So I would say they're not quite the same person.
Okay, intriguing. But Jack Reacher isn't going to change.
No, and that's one of the things that I think is important about a series. You know, why do people like a series? They like a series partly because it's familiar, comfortable. They kind of know what they're getting to a certain extent. And so the classic kind of English literature BA approach is to say, yeah, the character's got to change, it's got to learn, got to grow, got to go on a journey, there's got to be an arc. And I'm completely against that. I mean, all my effort goes into making him stay the same. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's what people expect. And of course, he can't quite stay the same because I'm changing. So he's going to change a little bit, but that's inadvertent.
Been some concessions over the last few books to Reacher's age. He's getting older. He had his nose broken for the first time in his life just recently. So how much of that, how much of his aging in real time are you incorporating into the books?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's that fine balance between fantasy and reality. You know, people expect books to be reality-based, you know, especially a thriller like this. But on the other hand, what they're really responding to is the mythic proportion of the characters. So you've got to have a fine balance. And in some ways, I do make concessions to reality. Like, after 9/11, it became harder to go around the world without ID, and banking was difficult. So I did make a concession there. He now has an expired passport, although in this book, he gets a real passport.
Yes.
And he has an ATM card, which I didn't really want to do, but I just thought, you know, you've got to at least acknowledge reality in some way. And the same thing with the age, you know, essentially a mythic character is frozen in time, but because of the realism required, you've got to sort of move it forward a little bit. So, and I base it on my own life. And actually, I felt pretty good up until, you know, mid-50s. There wasn't really much difference for me. But then, you know, since mid-50s, it's been like falling off a total cliff. So we've got to get Reacher, you know, we'll get him to the mid-50s and then sort of freeze him in aspic, I think.
You mention reality, but of course Reacher is name checked in Stephen King's Under the Dome.
He is, yeah.
And we were talking about this in the office the other day. So clearly the Reacherverse and the King universe are one and the same. So we're looking forward to an inevitable crossover.
Yeah, well, I think that you know, Stephen is so into popular culture. You know, he references things back and forth, and he takes great delight in that. And I was thrilled about that. Yeah, you know, because I loved Under the Dome. I thought it was actually a really significant novel. You know, not just the Stephen King thriller, but it was a kind of political allegory that really represented the last many years, I think. And so, yeah, for Reacher to show up in that, especially the way that he did, you know, the reference to him was very respectful. Mm. I thought that was terrific, yeah.
But well, that opens up an interesting can of worms, because if they are a part of the same universe, and Under the Dome obviously takes place, it's an alien, aliens are involved, and the King universe obviously has vampires and whatnot. How would Reacher deal with the supernatural? And is this a direction you might want to take him in down the line?
Well, Reacher can barely deal with the natural, let alone the supernatural. And I think, you know, Reacher's an intensely rational sort of person, and it would probably make his head explode if he had to acknowledge aliens, or at least aliens of the Stephen King kind. I mean, I think Reacher sees aliens everywhere. I mean, everybody's alien compared to Reacher.
I just wonder, I'd love to see Reacher punch one alien, just one. At one point in his life.
Yeah, but, you know, maybe the alien is insubstantial and the fist would go straight through without any resistance, which cause him to tear a ligament or something, especially at his age. You know.
Let's talk a little more about Personal, which is the 19th Jack Reacher novel. And you said Reacher doesn't change, but the environment around him changes. Mm. And this time he comes back to Paris, and he comes to London as well. He's been to London before, obviously, but this time the book is largely set in London. Why did you make that decision?
Simply because, as you say, you know, it needs to be the same but different. And the difference can be the environment, well, the type of story, of course. It can be a sort of lonely, dusty road type of story, or it can be a big, you know, CIA White House type of story. Mm-hmm. And it can be set anywhere. So I just thought, you know what, let's show the old guy a bit of glamour. And and you know, I don't plan. I don't make a plan at all. And I started out. He gets alerted through a personal ad in the Army Times, which inevitably he finds on a bus and inevitably leafs through just out of pure curiosity. And there's the ad: Jack Reacher, call somebody, which he does. And then we're straight onto a private plane that takes him across the continent. And then I send him to Arkansas. And I remember writing a good scene in Arkansas. I mean, it's a good chilling little sequence in Arkansas. But then I remember thinking, oh, really? Come on. Are we going to do it like Arkansas again? Or, so I thought, oh, no, let's send him to Paris. So all of a sudden he's in Paris. And partly because Reacher is this unchanging person and the environment around him changes. So you've got the fish out of water thing.
Yeah.
You know, this rather awkward guy is now in Paris, and I think that makes it all the more pointed what a fish out of water he is. Yeah. And then London, but you know, I didn't do the glamorous London. I didn't do the tourist London, the West End, and all of that kind of stuff. He's in Romford,
yes.
Which
Steve Davis country.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of, you know, it's just more interesting for Reacher, I think. It's certainly more at home there. You know, Bramford is like kind of certain parts of Queens, possibly, or Staten Island. And that's Reacher's more natural habitat.
It's like the new series of 24 when Jack Bauer goes to Ealing. It's a little unexpected. You weren't tempted to take him to the Midlands, have him pull the arms off some Granada executives, you know?
Well, if he went to the Midlands, of course, he'd have to stop at Villa Park. And, you know, he probably wouldn't get any further than that, really, would he?
I'm not going to talk to you about football because I'm a Liverpool fan, and Villa turned us over the weekend. And
as usual, yeah, Villa beat Liverpool in Anfield. You know, it's becoming an annual rite, really.
It's a sore point. It's a sore point. Any chance it could get relegated so we can avoid that next year?
I'm looking at, I mean, you know, second in the table as we speak, and I'm, you know, obviously that's not going to last, but I'm thinking, you know, from my point of view, this is one quarter of the way to safety with only four games gone. You know, how cool is that?
The mindset of an Aston Villa fan right there.
Totally.
Writers famously fall into two camps, plotters and pantsers, or architects and gardeners, if you're George R.R. Martin. You fall into the latter camp, is that fair to say?
Very fair to say, yeah. People say to me, do I know what's going to happen in, you know, in the next chapter? I say, I don't know what's going to happen in the next line.
And is it very much that sort of old adage that the character writes it for you? You just let him just do what he would do?
Yeah, I mean, that is a sort of shorthand way, because after all, whose fingers are on the keyboard? You know, I mean, let's be real, this guy doesn't exist. I'm doing the typing. But it's a shorthand way of saying, yeah, you know, just set up a problem. Now, what would happen? What would a person do in that situation? And I think it moves it, first of all, closer to real life, because we don't know what's going to happen next. You know, we have not got the next week or month of our lives planned out. And, of course, it brings it much closer to the reading experience. What happens to me is I sit down in the morning to write, or the afternoon to be technically accurate, sit down to write, and I'm just excited. What is going to happen today? In the same way that I want the reader to be excited. You know, the reader picks up the book and they think, wow, okay, what's going to happen? And so we're both literally on the same page. The reader doesn't know a page ahead. I don't know a page ahead.
But the stories get quite complicated, and they have lots of sort of threads to intertwine each other. Do you just have that naturally kind of multi-track mind that goes through that?
Yeah, I think it must be pretty natural or instinctive. But, of course, it's a slight illusion as well, because there are a lot of threads, but only some of them are important. And so, you know, you start, let's say you've got six threads running. Well, as the book progresses, you say, well, okay, thread four is going to be the significant one, whereupon it... Then the reader thinks, well, wow, he's had five red herrings. This is really sophisticated storytelling.
Have you ever written yourself into a corner that you can't get out of?
No, I that's obviously a big danger, and some people do that. You know, I've heard of people scrapping tens of thousands of words, but I just have this sort of efficient detector. I can usually tell within three or four words whether it's heading down the wrong alley. I don't think I've ever deleted more than, you know, six words.
Is there ever a situation you could write Reacher into that he couldn't get himself out of? I think not,
and that's part of the appeal. And I had this real interesting conversation with one writer who had, you know, his guy had to, he described this, I suppose, apartment block, which had a security device on the front door. And then much later in the book, he had to get his guy into that apartment block. And so he was very, very tempted to go back 200 pages and make the security device simpler. But in the end, he said, no, it is what it is. The guy has to get through. And that's what I do with Richard, that whatever the situation is, he has to be able to triumph. And you know, that keeps me alert, keeps me thinking, and it makes every problem genuine. You know, you can't just go back and make it easier. He has to conquer whatever the situation is.
So 20th Reacher novel, you've just begun it. Can you give us a sneak preview?
I can tell you the title. The title is Make Me.
Ooh.
And I can't give you a sneak preview because, as we've said, as we've gone along, I don't know what's going to happen. I've written the first couple of pages. I have no idea what's going to happen on page three.
Oh, wow. Has he hit anyone yet?
He has not. He's just gotten off a train. He hasn't hit anybody yet. That's coming soon, I imagine.
Give it time.
We have some very, very quick questions here, Lee, from readers. Tarek Ashkenani asks, is it true the Reacher books are actually a series of autobiographies?
Yeah, they're pretty much autobiographical in terms of all the sort of internal stuff. But for the violence, I try and tone it down for the books to keep it plausible.
At El Carius asks, I'd love to see a TV version of Reacher. Any chance? This is interesting because obviously Harry Bosch is coming to the small screen with Amazon.
Yeah, it is. But I, you know, the difference between me and Michael Connelly is I used to work in television and he didn't. So I'm staying away from it.
Fair enough. Bat Sphinx asks, why do you occasionally choose to write in the first person?
I like first person better. I think it's intimate. It's a great connection between the character and the reader, but it limits you in terms of plot. So for the sort of plot where you need to see behind the scenes or see what the bad guys are doing on Unknown, then you got to go third person.
Okay. Mark King, 1974, asks, which animal, when fired from a cannon, do you think you could catch?
Well, that would depend pretty much on their sort of organic integrity and size, because if it's a small furry thing, it's going to be in lots of little pieces and it would be difficult to catch them all. So I would probably go for a small baby armadillo.
Okay. Would it be quite... the shell might bounce off your hands. It might be quite tough to catch.
Well, you know, shell would be catchable at least. It wouldn't be like a sort of pink mist or a paste.
A good point. And the last one from a reader is from Carl Hughes, 001. In the Reacher forums, there's a lot of enthusiasm for a Reacher console game in the style of Grand Theft Auto. Any plans?
That's out of my hands. You know, all that stuff is handled by people who would buy the rights and so on. And so I'm a simple guy. All I do is write the books. What anybody does afterwards is up to them.
Okay. And then just a couple of last questions from us. I was once on a flight and saw Jim Carter from Downton Abbey reading, I think it was Worth Dying For. When was the last time you saw a famous person or heard of a famous person reading a Reacher book?
Well, you know, I'm not going to name drop, but I hear that like all the time. There's that guy Murakami, who's some very high-flown intellectual Japanese novelist. A month or so ago, I heard that he was in big trouble in Japan because he was sort of betraying his intellectual status by being a Reacher fan.
How does it make you feel when people say that?
Well, it makes me feel great because I'm one of, you know, I think these books are appealing to a wide span of people. And if you've got all these highbrow folks and then regular folks too, it shows you that it's working. Mm.
And there's an interesting series going on at the moment as well, written by Diane Capri, called The Hunt for Jack Reacher, in which I think it's two FBI agents searching for a Reacher. They're on the periphery of Reacher stories. Is that semi-authorized? I mean, obviously you're aware of it.
Yeah, it's authorized, and there's going to be more people doing it. I've said, as long as you do not show Reacher himself walking or talking, then help yourself. You know, the Reacher universe is open to everybody. And because a lot of these people, you know, publishing's tough. They don't have much luck. If you want to weigh into it that is kind of already pre-marketed, help yourself.
Including Stephen King.
Including Stephen King.
Yeah, I'm helping Stephen King every day.
You need small, struggling authors need that helping hand.
Yeah, Diane Capri, Stephen King. Yeah.
Fantastic, Lee Child. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure entirely. Great to see you.
Lovely Lee Child there. And now it's time for some lovely movie news. Let's start this week. It's New Empire Day. Let's get the quick shameless plug out of the way. And here to help us shamelessly plug the magazine is Dan Jolin of Empire Magazine. Hey, everyone. Dan Jolin.
Hey.
He's just appeared as if by magic via a wormhole.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Now, I imagine you're wondering why we called you here.
Yeah, I know. Why did I get dragged through a wormhole from the first floor?
I don't know. I do know. It's because this month's cover feature.
Yeah.
This month's cover feature is Interstellar. Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But you were on set of Interstellar?
Yeah. I might have mentioned it six or 70 times.
And then were you in the edit suite with Chris Nolan?
Well, technically, it was the sound. It was the dubbing. I was on the dub stage. Yeah.
And then did you and Chris Nolan go on holiday together and now are living very, very happily in London's...
No. But we did go on holiday around the same time. But I went to Scotland, and I'm sure he went somewhere. Not that there's anything wrong with Scotland, because I love Scotland. But I'm sure he went somewhere even more exotic and wonderful.
More exotic and wonderful than Scotland?
Yes. And that's hard to believe.
I don't believe
No.
Anyway, back to the magazine, though. So tell us about Interstellar, but without giving away spoilers, because then I believe that the hitman standing behind you, who seems to have been hired by Chris Nolan, will actually shoot you in the head.
Well, actually, I'd like to, you know, obviously spoilers, where everyone's obsessed with spoilers. You can read this feature. I just want to assure everyone, you can read this feature. Don't worry. There's nothing in it. There are even some things that I know that I didn't put in because I didn't want to... spoil anything, literally.
Yeah, I remember doing that when I was on set of X-Men Days of Future Past.
Exactly. Chris,
Exactly. Like that. And honestly, obviously, Chris and I have been on so many amazing big films with, you know, we found out so many amazing things
so
that
many
we
amazing.
Just couldn't tell anyone.
Oh, my God.
And it hurts, doesn't it, Chris?
It does hurt.
You're bursting to tell
as
people.
As I was saying to Joss Whedon on the set of The Avengers.
Yeah.
All right, just stop it. Let's get back to the magazine.
First line of the dance feature... is Christopher Nolan is flying a spaceship.
Yes.
Whee!
That's not a fake out. Okay? I just want to say that's not a fake out opener. I turned up. He's basically, they were shooting, built all these sets, the same place they built the Batcave for Batman Begins. And they've got all the interior spaceship sets there, or they did. So I turned up, and I was shown in, and there was this, you know, massive, you know, several ton huge spaceship thing, which we've now seen in the trailers. It's the Ranger, the ship that reminds me of the Lotus Esprit from The Spy Who Loved Me. And it was this like full size or 80% full size thing, absolutely massive, up on this gimbal. Nolan standing there with this thing. I turned out it's called a Waldo. It's in the piece. You learn a lot here. It's a piece of sort of like, you know, copper triangle thing that he wiggles around. And when he wiggled it, it made the ship itself move. And there's an IMAX camera attached to the side of the thing, fixed to the side for the sort of perspective. And it's a shot of the ship coming down into the atmosphere of another planet.
Wow.
Every movement he made on the Waldo made this huge ship shake and twist and turn, and it sort of like tipped upwards and, you know, tilted downwards and was all moving around. And, you know, in this day and age of, as we all do, we all do turn up on these, well, maybe except Phil, who does more respectable, worthy things. We turn up on these massive, huge sound stages with green screen everywhere. And there was, and this is a line that comes up in the feature as well, I didn't see any green screen when I was there, and they hadn't shot any green screen while I was there. And yet it's set in space, most of it.
I'm getting chills.
And Nolan seemed to be having the time of his life.
Well, of course you were there.
Had he ever felt like this before?
Don't put Christopher Nolan in a corner.
Just remember, Dan.
Yes. It was a great day. I went wandering around the sets. I sat in, you know, Matthew McConaughey's pilot seat. A technical day, which everyone was very apologetic. Said, oh, sorry, it's a technical day. It's a technical day. And I was just like, hey, this is great. I could spend all day. At one point, the producer, Emma Thomas, I was sitting in this, there's another ship called the Lander, I'll explain, and it's designed so that the ship could actually flip upside down, but everyone sat in their seats would stay the right way up.
Ooh.
All the seats are kind of, sorry, I'm doing hand gestures here, which isn't useful, but all the seats are on these kind of pivots, these rods, if you like, so mm-hmm. that when things turn around them, they stay in the same position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The kind of little cradles almost. So I sat in this seat, like legs are sort of either side of a little joystick thing.
Mm-hmm.
And producer Emma Thomas actually started swinging me on this seat. It was like a little kind of, you know,
Whee!
Playground ride or something like that. I was like, Whee, I'm shooting TIE fighters. Yay. I'm very professional and it was a very valuable day. Good business critical day.
Good, good, good. And how would you rate your feature out of 10? Did you?
I don't rate my own features. No. I don't rate my own features.
I would say it's one of Dan's best. It's a really good long form read. Like, there's a lot of information in there without, I would agree, spoilers.
Okay.
Well, but I do feel like I learned a lot from it.
Hang on, I'll be the judge of that. Hang on.
We're not going to stop the whole thing for you to read the entire feature, Chris. It's thousands of words.
That's pretty good so far. Oh, Jonah Nolan's in it. That's good. That's good. All right. No, it's very good. But Dan, your interstellar feature forms the centerpiece, doesn't it,
mm-hmm.
of a galaxy of features within the magazine. Tell us about that as well.
Well, yeah, it's something because Nolan talks about, he's always happy to talk about his influences. He's not shy of them. A very obvious one is 2001, A Space Odyssey. And I think when you see the film, you will really see the connection there. And another one that he brought up when we were talking that I hadn't really anticipated was The Right Stuff. So we thought, well, let's sort of respect this and celebrate this. So we tracked down Keir Dullea, and I'm really sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong.
I've never known how to pronounce his name.
Keir Dullea? I don't know.
I would say Dullea, anyway. But...
We tracked him down. He is, of course, Dave from 2001.
Just, there's something amazing about a guy called Keir Dullea playing Dave. Yeah. Yeah, I'm Dave.
Dave the astronaut. So Dave the astronaut talked to
us. What
are
you doing, Dave?
Yeah. About that thing.
That isn't how Hal pronounces it, is it?
Dave. Stop that, Dave.
Well, actually, Dave. On set, that probably was how Hal pronounced it, because one of the stories Keir tells is because they recast the voice of Hal, they got one of the crew people to be the voice of Hal while he was doing those scenes. And Hal, yeah, did talk a bit like this, really.
Bloody nail, Dave.
Yeah. Daisy, give me your answer, do. So we talked to Keir Dullea about his experience being in 2001. It's actually like, what did it feel like being in those sets and, you know, being someone in that environment? Mm. And then we also talked to Philip Kaufman.
Kaufman.
Yeah. About The Right Stuff, which is an overlooked American classic. It's a film that too few people have seen, considering how influential and brilliant it is.
And they should read the book as well.
And the book's brilliant.
Yeah. Indeed, an amazing example of the new journalism.
Indeed.
So, which is very inspiring to everyone in this room, I imagine.
Loves.
Yeah. So we broke those two things out. We also have got some focus pieces on the spaceships, the three spaceships that appear in the film, and the robots.
Ooh, I'm excited by the robots.
There are robots.
Yeah, I'm
excited. Case and TARS. So there's a bit of info there on the robots.
Awesome. It really is, I guess, the first proper in-depth look anywhere in the world at this movie.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely huge. Yeah. And you spoke to McConaughey as well.
I did, yes. He lay down on the floor in front of me. It was surprising, but it was fair enough.
Which is something that happens to you all the time.
Yeah. It's like saying the piece, he said he's a guy who's so laid back, he was literally laid back. The lovely Anne Hathaway spoke with her about slipping and sliding around on glaciers in Iceland. For this film, not just for fun. Mm-hmm. Jessica Chastain as well, I spoke to, and then all the amazing heads of department, technical people, great talent people like Paul Franklin, Nathan Crowley. It was, yeah. Access all areas, Chris.
Fantastic. I'm just laughing because Stan writes the contents every month, which are, if you never read the contents, because most people don't in magazines, knowing that, Dan then takes the opportunity to just go nuts in the content section, and every month it's very, very funny. And I just read your joke about The Right Stuff, which won't make people at home laugh now, but it made me laugh. Philip Kaufman reflects on his space race classic and resists our attempts to call him the Jägermeister.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh at my own joke.
Yeah, no, sure. Yeah, but still. Okay, you got to go, haven't you?
I have to go somewhere very special.
And very top secret.
And very top secret, but it will be revealed in 2 issues' time.
Yes, it will. It will indeed. It will indeed.
Bye, everyone. Bye.
Bye, Dan.
Bye, Dan.
Bye, Dan. Bye. Dan, Geraldine, everybody. Bye. Don't like that guy. There's something about him.
But there's more in the issue than just Interstellar, although the Interstellar stuff is reason enough to buy. But we celebrate 15 years of The West Wing. James Dyer has spent genuinely nearly a year putting this together. He has talked to everyone involved in The West Wing, pretty much, and assembled an oral history, the likes of which the world has never seen. So if you've ever wanted to know anything about The West Wing, it will be in there.
If you were involved in The West Wing in some capacity and James has not spoken to you, then please do come forward. We'd like to know your identity and sort of close the loop on that
and
one.
And also
bit.
Just check that you're okay. I mean, you know, presumably there's a reason.
It is phenomenal. Jimbo was deep involved in this feature. His first draft was 42,000 words long. I'm not kidding. 42,000 words long. The actual feature is about 4,000. It's great. He spoke to everybody. Sorkin, Sheen, the one who walks around and talks a bit.
Richard Schiff, everybody. Yeah. It's wonderful. And there is also a little treat, or big treat, in there for Cumber fans. Cumber ladies.
Yes. Benedict Cumberbatch is this month's big interview. Very fun interview he did with Ollie Richards while he was racing through Heathrow to catch a flight. Benedict Cumberbatch, that is. Not Ollie Richards, he's not allowed to travel. There are other features as well. Brad Pitt's Fury, we were deep inside. We're in the tank for that one, you could say. That's just Mr. Turner as well, Timothy Spall and Mike Leigh's latest collaboration. We talked to them both on that one as well. It's a really good, really, really solid issue as well. There's all the usual movie news as well. We have set visits from the likes of Night at the Museum, Secret of the Tomb. There's a picture of Dan Stevens, our new spirit animal, in there if anyone wants to pick that one out. There's a really funny set visit on the set of Get Santa, which is stars Jim Broadbent as Santa Claus, which just seems right. Somehow, yeah. Just seems perfect. Yeah. There's a great piece on Nightcrawler, the new Jake Gyllenhaal film, which could be a dark horse in the Oscar race. David Koepp talks about Mordecai for the first time. Liam Neeson and Olivier Megaton, the director with the most explosive name in movies, talk about Taken 3 for the first time. Some really, really interesting stuff in there as well. Simon Kinberg talks about Star Wars Rebels, which is a very, very interesting interview as well. We got something on The Babadook as well, which is the year's scariest film. And Mads Mikkelsen becomes the second Hannibal Lecter to take the How Much Is a Pint of Milk Q&A. That's very, very funny as well. It's a cracking issue. Lots of good stuff in there. £3.99 from all good and evil and undecided news agents. So do pick it up. It's also available as well on the IPID, which I believe is how you pronounce that. Right, that's it for movie news, isn't it? I mean, there's got to be nothing else. This is pretty much it. New issue of Empire's out. You should go and buy it immediately, and let's move on.
I don't think so, Chris. I think we've got a few stories to go first. The first thing, which is something we've all seen coming for a long time, but it's been confirmed officially,
yes,
is that Bryan Singer will direct X-Men Apocalypse, mm-hmm. Which is, of course, the next installment in the sort of first-class era of the X-Men, pushing it forward another 10 years. So we're now in the 80s, and they are facing En Sabanur, the oldest mutant around, arguably, who knows, in the depths of the comics.
They'll retcon it again.
But he is a serious, serious threat to all mutants, and they must band together and defeat him.
Yes, or do they?
Or does
Magneto team up with him, or does Magneto go nuts again?
Probably not, maybe. Like, yeah.
You know, get out of my place, En Sabanur, he'll
say. Call me Magneto.
Jesus. Yeah, intriguing. That's coming out in 2016.
Yeah.
So he's going straight into that. I presume he was talking at one point maybe doing a smaller project.
It would have to be pretty darn small.
It would have to be very small. It would have to be like Kevin Smith sized, you know, like one of those films you can make in 2 weeks, something like that. I've gone very Irish all of a sudden. Yeah, very intriguing. Very intriguing indeed. And also there's been the Deadpool news happened after we came out last week.
So it did.
Which is the news that Fox have finally given the green light to Deadpool as a direct result of the footage that leaked, and I'm doing air quotes, you can't see them, but it leaked onto the internet and everyone went, hey, this Deadpool movie looks quite good, and Fox went, yes, we agree with you, and let's make one now. So there's Tim Miller, the director, is still attached. Just, I think they're trying to work out Ryan Reynolds' deal.
I think so. He's always been keen, so you've got to imagine he's trying to make it happen.
Indeed.
And I just hope that they give it a small enough budget that they can keep the edges on. I think that's the real key here. We don't actually need a giant city-threatening, apocalypse thing at the end. What we need is something small enough that it can be tough.
Well, this is what I think has happened with both of Hugh Jackman's Wolverine movies, in that they start off with the best of intentions to be gritty and downbeat and just about him. And then they panic. They go, no, we need more mutants. And so that's why I think Viper was in the last one, and that's why I think Silver Samurai turned up, and it's hot. Just the last 20 minutes of that movie is just, it goes off the rails so spectacularly after what is a fairly decent build up. And obviously with X-Men Origins Wolverine, there were so many mutants, it became an X-Men movie in all but name.
Yeah, it did.
And it'd be nice if they could stick to the guns with Deadpool.
I suppose the idea of just cutting out blood to get a PG-13 is always one that infuriates me. You get, there was ridiculous situations like in the Golden Compass where a character's jaw is ripped off but nary a drop of blood is spilled. You're trying to get the effect of violence without the actual violence, which is insane. The problem is you need it to be twisted and you need it to be dark. And I think if it isn't, we might be headed into some problems. But fingers crossed, we don't know anything yet. It's all very early stages, so there is hope for Deadpool, and I think that's important to remember.
Hope for Deadpool. Hashtag justice for Deadpool. Also, talking about something we've known for a long, long time, Dan mentioned True Detective and Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
So this cast has been rumoured for a long, long time, but it was confirmed this week that Vince Vaughn and Colin Farrell will be two of the stars, not the stars necessarily, but two of the stars of the second season of True Detective. Mm. One playing a cop, one playing a career criminal. The internet went nuts at this in a weird way. It was like, these guys are good actors. I don't quite get it.
I think, to be honest, I can see that, you know, Vince Vaughn's career over the last few years has not given us many stone cold classics, I think it's probably fair to say. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, surely that just means that he has more to prove than any man alive going into a True Detective series and will be, you know, pulling out the stops to blow us all away. I mean, I think it's exactly what he probably needs in terms of just reminding us that he isn't just about rubbish comedies. And I think it's something that he has hinted at in the past and shown in the past that he can do. So I'm actually pretty stoked about this. And I think Colin Farrell, I mean, people tend to be love him or hate him. I tend to fall into the former camp. I think no man alive does guilt better than Colin Farrell. It's part of our Irish charm. Mm-hmm. So I think he could be really interesting as a sort of, it sounds like he's a slightly corrupted cop. He's certainly in league with mobsters. So that should be right in his wheelhouse.
Yeah, I don't quite get it. I think it's good casting myself. Phil, what do you think?
I think I like Colin Farrell. I think he's got, I like him as a comic actor. I'm not sure he's going to be doing that much in this, but I think he's got good range. I'm not so sure about Vince Vaughn. His range seems a little limited, but perhaps it's been limited by the roles he's taken, which have been written for him and that persona of his. So I don't know. I mean, I thought the first season was great. It certainly deserves us to go into the second one with an open mind. I'm not sure where all the fury has come from for that, personally.
People got to be angry about something.
Yeah, I guess. I have another quick story which came through yesterday, which is news that Roger Donaldson, who's been around for eons, making pretty good films, including No Way Out, a personal favourite, is remaking All Quiet on the Western Front, which of course was made famous by Ernest Borgnine in the 80s and the Oscar-winning film in the late 20s. It may or may not star Mark Radcliffe. Mark Radcliffe? Yeah. The DJ.
Daniel.
It may or may not star Daniel Radcliffe, who's been sort of linked with the project for quite a while. It's been in the ether, but obviously with the First World War anniversaries over the next 4 years, it's probably one that's going to get the green light quite soon.
I mean, Daniel Radcliffe has World War One previous, doesn't he, from the Rudyard Kipling TV series?
That's right,
which he was in. So was that My Boy, Our Boy?
Yeah, about Rudyard Kipling's son.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, he played him. Exactly, he does. I can totally see him in the role.
Yeah.
Be interesting to make a film now from the enemy's point of view, which is obviously what the film is. It's from the book, Eric Marie Remarque's book, novel was the German experience of the First World War in the trenches. Yeah. But
I think its worldwide popularity ever since just shows that it captures the universal experience of that war. It's not, it's not jingoistic in that sense. There's jingoistic characters in it, but it's not a film that is limited in its relevance to Germany, definitely. So, fingers crossed for
a Warhorse cameo as well, potentially. sort of prancing across the horizon, potentially.
So it all takes place in a Warhorseverse. At least shared universe movies are getting out of hand now. They really are. This is weird. The cast of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies is growing bigger by the week and getting better by the week as well, because now Charles Dance and Lena Headey have joined the cast.
Yeah.
This can't be good, this movie, can it?
It's upsetting you, isn't it? Because you'd planned to completely ignore it and now there's all these people in it and you want to watch it. Yeah.
Say in the lines.
Be strong, Chris. Come on.
I mean, listen. I don't understand.
Maybe they will find a tone that totally works for this. Maybe they can just keep that sort of straight-faced ridiculousness and make it really work. We don't write things off, Chris. Come on.
We don't write things off. Every day is Christmas Eve at Empire. But you know, Christmas Eve, all your presents are under the tree, and you know that one's going to be an iPad, right?
Do you? Wow. Your house sounds awesome.
No, sorry, I live with Cameron Diaz and Jason Segel. You know one's going to be an iPad, or you're hoping one's going to be an iPad, and if there's not, you're going to take the Twitter and have a go with your parents. You know that one's going to be a pair of moldy socks.
Right?
I'm just saying.
Yeah, but would all these people wear moldy socks? It just doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right.
I may be stretching the metaphor.
It doesn't seem right. Charles Dance to me is the sort of guy that, gets an iPad for Christmas. I don't know where I'm going with this anymore, but anyway, that's basically it, I think, for the movie news.
I think
just
so, yes.
Just so there's some X-Men Apocalypse Farrell websites already online.
There
two
are,
years before,
yeah.
A year and a half before the movie comes out. Okay, that's it for the movie news. Our second guest this week is Antoine Fuqua, the director of this week's Denzel Washington thriller, The Equalizer, which marks the first time the duo have worked together since Training Day in 2001, which of course marked the second time that Denzel won an Oscar. Since then, Fuqua's had a varied career, taking in the likes of the ill-fated King Arthur and the Mark Wahlberg actioner Shooter, to name but two. But he's back with The Equalizer, adding to last year's guilty pleasure, Olympus Has Fallen, and soon to be followed by potential Oscar shot, Southpaw, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, and the remake of The Magnificent Seven, which once again will star Denzel Washington. Mr. Fuqua came into our pod booth to have a very frank and funny chat with Ali Plum, and yes, it's me again. Sorry. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the director of The Equalizer, and Training Day, of course, and Olympus Has Fallen, Mr. Antoine Fuqua. Hello, sir. How are
you? Hello. I am good.
Good. How was my pronunciation of your surname?
It was perfect. Yeah, you should hear some of the other ones.
When I was
in Japan, it was Antoine Fuqua.
Really?
Yeah, that's not good.
With the hard emphasis on the fuck.
Hard emphasis on the fuck, yeah.
Yeah.
Antoine Fuqua. I'm just like, and it's shocking because you can't correct it. It's not like they're going to fix it. Yeah, that's my name. Fuck it.
Today, that's my name.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Equalizer, if someone said the name wrong for the Equalizer, there would be more of a comeuppance. You're not going to whip out some garden furniture.
No, but I'm looking at these microphones and wires and stuff and thinking, if they get my name wrong, this little plastic bottle here is going to somebody's eye.
Well, you know, it's recycling. It's good for the environment.
It's
so
good, man.
We're happy with that.
Used for something.
But it's also the second remake of an Edward Woodward property. The first, of course, was Neil LaBute's The Wicker Man with Nicolas Cage.
Right, that's right.
Now, when you're making this movie, was that hanging over your head like the sword of Damocles? Like, you know, we best not repeat the mistakes of The Wicker Man. We need to get this right.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The thing is, you do think about that. I do. You know what I mean? But then you just throw it out and just make the best version of the script that you have. And, you know, you recreate the character. And I thought about him as the, sort of the seed of that character. You would imagine, you know, a guy like Edward, which I didn't watch the show as much. I was young. I was running around in the streets. And at that time, I think Miami Vice was on. And my mother and my grandmother loved Edward. You know, he was in the suit and a nice Jaguar. He's all cool and his accent, you know. And I was watching Miami Vice with the Ferraris and the girls on the beach, you know. So, you know. But I what I loved about the show that Edward did was it was always about a man doing the right thing without wanting any recognition for it. And it was just helping people who couldn't help themselves. And that always stuck with me. So when we did this, the writer, Richard Wink, wrote a really good script. And Denzel and myself sat and talked a lot about that character. And I thought, you know, if we saw the beginning of where Edward came from the very seeds of it, he could easily been that type of guy as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We saw him already when he was established and, you know, he already was doing a certain deeds. Where Denzel's character is becoming the equalizer.
Could well be your first franchise, so to speak. I mean, are you going to hang around for a sequel if it were to happen?
You know, it's always up to the people, right? Movies belong to the people. So, like your Star Wars shirt.
Yeah.
So, you know, if the people show up and really enjoy it and they're interested in Robert McCall, there's a lot of story to be told. I would definitely love to do it. If Sony wants to do it, I'm there. You know, I think it can be, and I don't think it should stay in the United States. By the way, I think it can travel.
He's got a passport.
Yeah, he's got a passport, and he's a normal guy. He can just live anywhere. You know, there's no reason he has to live in Boston.
And if you do take it, say, over to the UK for the sequel, will you make sure that it's Equalizer with an S rather than with a Z?
Hey, that has nothing to do with me, man. That's an American thing. That's the big wigs who decided on that one.
It's got nothing to do with football, just to make that absolutely clear. It's about a man who works in a garden centre. What's it like to shoot so much of a movie, a decent chunk of a movie, inside a garden centre? Was that a difficult set to find? And was there a moment where you looked at yourself and went, I'm directing Denzel Washington working in a garden center today?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what happens. In fact, it was a place that we found. We got lucky, and it was an abandoned Lowe's or something like that.
Okay.
So we took it over, but nothing was in it. So we had to put all the stuff in it. And, you know,
Are you kidding? You had to fill a garden
center? Yeah, we filled that. It was crazy. Yeah, that's a lot of stuff. You know, it's the biggest yard sale you ever saw in your life, I'm sure Sony had. But, you know, I'm shooting. Also, he had the ball head. You know how he looked. He's got the, you know, the big, one guy called him fisherman clothes. You know, the big pants up here and stuff like that. And I'm shooting him, pushing the dolly down the aisle, and I'm thinking, I was just in a car with Denzel a few years ago, and he was a badass with the chains on and Dr. Dre music, and now he's pushing a dolly in a garden center. What the fuck? You know what I mean? He's just, okay. But, hey, he makes it work, and he's just trying to blend into the world. But when he's not in the garden center, he's dishing out some punishment.
He really is. And there are moments where his character really gets inventive when it comes to dispatching enemies. How fun was it discussing possible dispatching methods outside of shooting? Were you like, well, we could do something fun with, I don't know, a pair of pliers? I don't know.
You should have saw my office. It was a torture chamber. But it all came out of, like, it came out of the narrative. It came out of meeting with my buddy who's one's an SAS guy.
Okay.
And another guy's a Navy SEAL and all that. And, they, you know, we literally talked about what, if it was a certain room, what they may use if they had to. These things are there. So it came out of that. And it also informs you about this guy a little bit, because the exposition is boring. And you could see more by physically what he does, and you could start to put in your own mind, he obviously comes from that violent background, to know how to do that anyway in the first place. But yeah, it was fun, to answer your question.
Yeah.
And there were some days where there were some things on the desk where Denzel would walk in and go, you're sick. Like, what are you going to do with that? You got to use the drill.
you've talked about, like, maybe moving it somewhere else, and I made that terrible joke about Z and S's. But speaking of things coming to Britain, London has fallen. is a film that you're not involved with. I'm going to ask a couple of questions about Olympus Has Fallen. Mm-hmm. Was it you who was anything to do with the bust of, I think, Abraham Lincoln being slammed into the guy's head? Was that you that came up with that?
Yeah, it was. I don't know if it was written in the script or not, but we just were having some fun, me and Gerard. You know what I mean? And it was like, yeah, let's hit him upside the head with the Lincoln bust. You know what I mean? It was kind of one of those things. I'm not sure if it was in the script or not. It may have been, but we cracked it. And you know how heavy that thing really is?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you couldn't lift that up and swing it that way, you know, but we made a good replica, you know.
Do you have to get permission from the White House to hit someone over the head with a Lincoln bust?
Yeah, we sent Obama a couple of letters and he sent it back and he said...
Olympus Has Fallen also has probably my favorite line of any movie from last year, which is, let's play a game of fuck off, you go first.
Oh, yeah, that was in the script. That was in the script. Jerry delivered it well. Yeah, let's play a game of fuck off, you go first. It's a Ricky Orn. That was fun, man, you know. And then, you know, Olympus Has Fallen, was it London Has Fallen, they call it?
Yeah.
I didn't like the script at all. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's tricky to do that personally, but you know, I think it's tricky. You know, you have to really be careful with that, I think, you know.
Well, that's sort of Die Hard, how can the same shit happen the same
way? Yeah, you know, and then also, you know, London, I don't know the London, I mean, the White House, again, I met with some friends that helped me lay that out. And, you know, you leave stuff out as far as the security, because there's certain things they have in place that couldn't happen, of course. But I don't know the system here enough to make a movie about how the guys really work here and what could you use here. I could have sat with some SAS guys, former SAS guys, and just talk with them just for fun. Mm-hmm. But I think it's tricky when you're doing that. And I think, I don't know, I just think it's tricky. And then, like I said, the script wasn't, I didn't like the script.
That movie, I know, Olympus Has Fallen, was basically, you were very much up against it in terms of deadlines right from the off, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I prepped it in less than 6 weeks.
Wow.
It was crazy. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah. Seriously, there were some days where I thought I need to see a psychiatrist, that I even took that job because we had to build the White House. We built that on the lawn, a lot of that.
Yeah.
Because I had to actually shoot it and physically be on it with the guys going up the steps. And my production designer, Derek Hill, is a pretty amazing guy. And he did Oliver Stone's movie W. So he already knew certain things.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, that's a good start. So immediately we started putting it together and laying it out. And we shot that part of it in Shreveport. Have you been to Shreveport?
I've been.
Don't.
Yeah.
It's like the armpit of the world, okay? And it was 100 and something degrees every day, and I'm in Shreveport, man. It's just like I thought I was in purgatory. I said, did I do something wrong? Did I die?
Did you not unwind at the casinos?
The casino, it's like the dirtiest place in the world, right? The chips alone probably have some sort of asbestos on it. But it's bad, man. But we shot down there, and then we went to D.C. and did the plates and all that kind of stuff and him running around. But, man, that was a rough one, I got to tell you. You know, plus, we were racing against Sony's.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you won.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, the audience chose.
They did.
I just did my job.
And quickly.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this is a Sony movie.
Luckily, they hired me to do Equalizer, so it all worked out.
Absolutely. Because the point I was getting at about that was you had such a compressed production schedule on Olympus Has Fallen. Mm. I would have thought you had been taking a 6-month holiday after that, but you went straight into the Equalizer, didn't you?
I went straight into the Equalizer. I think I prepped that in 7 weeks.
Wow.
Roughly.
Okay.
Something like that. And then I just finished shooting Southpaw, the boxing movie I've been working on for a while with Jake Gyllenhaal, and I'm editing that right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm starting to, starting to put together my next one with Denzel, The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what, man? I've been an athlete my whole life. I love the energy of that. I think pressure is good. I mean, when you physically can do it. I think I get better each time I evolve and learn a lot from the last movie. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's like anything you do, the more you do it, the more consistent you do it, you learn some things. You learn some, you look at your mistakes or the things you did well and you try to adjust. I think when you sit around just being comfortable, you know, especially if you're lucky enough to continue to work and make movies, you should take that knowledge and immediately put it to work if you physically can.
Yeah, we have a director over here, I don't know whether you've seen any of his films, Ben Wheatley, who does, he's very, very prolific. He's made 4 films in 4 years, shoots films in 2 to 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very interesting to see you're working that hard as well. How long did Southpaw take?
Shot Southpaw, and was it 42 days? Somewhere around it, 42 days?
Yeah
about 42 days to shoot it and prepped it. And I think I prepped that one about 8 weeks. Somewhere. Not a lot of prep, you know, maybe 8 weeks, something like that. But I've been working on that one for about 5 years. I mean, I got it from Steven Spielberg years ago, and Harvey Weinstein, you know, went and got it for me when I called him. And Eminem was going to play the role at first, and his schedule got tied up, but he gave us, you know, some great music and stuff. And then I got Jake Gyllenhaal. And when you see him, let me see that picture. And when you see him, what I did with him, man, he's a beast. I changed him. He's going to be like what Denzel was in Training Day.
Oh, my God.
I had him training twice a day, took him to Mayweather's gym in Vegas, trained him with our training man, Denzel's trainer, Terry Claiborne, who has fighters. I took him to every fight, Pacquiao, Mayweather, you know, every fight we can get to, Cotto fight in New York. And literally, that's what I did with him.
Jeepers. Just seen a, you know, just been shown a picture of Jake Gyllenhaal. Wow, that CG work on Jake is pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, yeah. You tell him that. That's twice a day, every day, grinding it out in the gym.
Did he go straight into that from, say, Nightcrawler, where he lost loads of weight?
Yeah,
as well?
You saw him in Nightcrawler. He was a skinny little guy, weird guy. I saw him the other day.
Did he do the voice for you? Because I know he likes doing his monologue from that, and it's he becomes this really creepy guy.
Yeah, yeah, it's very creepy. Because I met him when he was doing that.
Oh, really?
We had met years ago, but I sat down and talked to him about Southpaw, and this little skinny guy came to meet me, and I was sitting there going like, I don't know, I'm going to turn this guy into a boxer. I mean, good God. And so I said, all right, you need to come to the gym. Let me see if you can even throw a punch. And he was already just kind of this 160-something pounds playing that role.
Yeah.
And I said, I need you to be at least 185 fighting weight, and I need you to be in the gym every day boxing and learn how to do it. And he threw a punch at my trainer and looked at me and said, no fucking way. And I was like, this guy's committed. He can do it. He's got, he gives his heart. And he did, man. He every day turned him into a fighter. I had Victor Ortiz. He got slapped around a lot because that real boxer's working with him.
Yeah.
But he did it. So, yeah, I enjoy the process. I mean, you know, at some point it's good to take a break and really develop your other material and stuff. But I don't know, man, you know.
If you're on a roll, you're on a roll.
Yeah, and I just think for me, it's just sharpening your knife.
Yeah.
Just learning, getting better. Spending time with the audience, more immediate, because the world is changing so quickly.
Mm.
You know, you make movies and you make them for the audience. And sometimes, you know, I just learned about, what's the other thing? Just a Vine?
Yeah.
Okay, so I got to get caught up. I have a 22-year-old son who's obviously been leaving things out. He hasn't been telling me all the new stuff. There must be a reason. But, you know, so it's like it's changing in the pulse changes so quickly. And then sometimes it's good to just, you know, stay on it.
How many weeks prep are you going to give yourself for Magnificent Seven?
I got some time. I mean, I'm literally I'm editing Southpaw. The trick with that one is that Harvey Weinstein will like it out by December, at least for a couple theaters, which is kind of hardcore.
Yeah.
But I edit while I'm shooting. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, so that's what I spend my my weekends doing, and my editor works all week. So it's a possibility, maybe. Depends on how well it's coming together. And then Mag 7, I literally start soft prep now. Scouting, casting, designing, things like that. So I'll have a little more time on that one. Yeah.
So you have Denzel?
Yeah, I have Denzel.
Presumably he's one of the seven.
He's the number one.
He's the number one.
Yeah. So seven he's, people.
Yeah, he could actually, you know. He'd be Eddie Murphy and do them all. You know?
That'd be amazing. Are you, I know you're not going to give us any names right now, but are you looking to, I guess, replicate the original movie, which had huge stars, and then peppered out the rest of the seven with, you know, the likes of Brad Dexter and Horst Buchholz, you know, really good character actors. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're looking to do, or are you looking for seven big names?
No, not definitely almost seven big names. I'm just looking to, you know, maybe there'll be one or two other guys, like, you know, like the Steve McQueens and all those guys, Charles Bronson type. Mm. But mainly, I think it's about just great actors. Because Denzel's an amazing actor, and I don't think you need seven stars. I mean, Expendables does that kind of thing. Mm. I don't want to do that. I just want to get great actors, you know, from wherever they are in the world and who have a passion for this.
And it's a proper old-school Western? Is that what you're going for?
Oh, yeah.
Are you going to
shoot on film?
Yeah.
Anamorphic, IMAX, widescreen, all of it.
Monument Valley?
All of it, man.
All of it, man.
Yeah, you know, I mean, why not, right? I mean, it's... There's no reason for us to stop making movies about different things. It's almost like, you know, I'm really happy that MGM is going to do it because, you know, sometimes people live in a bubble and they just kind of go, we only make these kind of movies. You're like, why would you do that? You know what I mean? There's stories to tell about different environments, different times in our lives, and we haven't seen a great Western. When was the last time you saw a great Western?
True Grit, probably, 2010.
Yeah, True Grit's probably the only one, but I mean, how many years ago was that?
Yeah, just a few years
and
ago.
It did really well. So, yeah. You know, why would you stop? Why would you not make another one? Yeah. How many superhero movies have you made so far? I mean, over and over.
We'll let you go, Antoine. I just want to ask one very, very last question. You didn't incorporate the classic Equalizer theme tune into your version of the Equalizer. Right. But as you said, Magnificent Seven has one of the great theme tunes. Have you any plans what you might want to do with that now?
No, I don't. I don't really. I mean, I want to reach out to Morricone. I love the Sergio Leone era. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a way to blend things nowadays, you know what I mean, to do something really cool that gives a nod to that, but then make it contemporary.
Yeah.
The Equalizer, I mean, you know, Harry Gregson Williams, who's British, English, great composer, he did the Equalizer. And, you know, we just wanted to have our own theme. I think, you know, this generation deserves its own theme, you know, so instead of going through the past, what's going to be the theme now that somebody else will make later, then they'll throw mines out. They'll go do theirs, you know. Moving forward, man.
Indeed. Wish you all the best. Antoine, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, man. Good talking to you guys, man.
It's time now for the reviews. Let's start with the Equalizer.
Well, look, the thing is, I saw it a couple of weeks ago, and my expectation levels were reasonably low.
Uh-huh.
I remember the Ewa-Woo-Wah Edward Woodward Equalizer a little bit as a kid when you were supposed to go to bed and it was on late and you'd sit there and it was not all that brilliant.
All I remember is the title sequence. It's him in an alleyway.
And he's like in a puddle and there's a car. That's all I can remember. And this is a similar scenario. I'm not going to lie to you. I remember there's a big hardware, like a B&Q. I remember Denzel fighting Martin Shokas. How do you say his name?
I say Shokas. He probably says it a completely different way. But I'm right.
In America, it'd be Shokas. Mm. Martin Shokas is a Russian. He's kind of like, he's the factotum, should we say, a violent kind of fix-it guy for a Russian oligarch type, a criminal mastermind who's for most of the movie out of sight over the horizon. Ooh. And through a congruence of events, which our reviewer Kim Newman has rightly kind of paralleled with Taxi Driver, Denzel Washington's character, who's got a shady sort of special ops background, falls in with Chloe Grace Moretz's kind of cool girl, and she is in the pay of one of Martin Shokas's kind of henchmen, basically. And she comes to some violence at his hands. Denzel's kind of more paternal than Travis Bickle's sort of outlook gets him involved. He doesn't want to, he wants to hold the stuff back, but he can't help himself. He has this kind of inner Ronin-like nobility, and it gets him into a very, what you'd think is a lethal situation. He's in a room, in a nightclub, upstairs, out of sight, out of mind, dealing with about 9 heavily tattooed, heavily armed Russians. But what he has, his secret weapon, is the fact that he's basically a superhero. No one knows that, and there's no reason why he's a superhero, but he can kind of slow time, calculate things, all these kind of like tricksy devices that Antoine Fuqua kind of employs to show his kind of de facto powers enables him to kill all these people. And so that's early on in the movie. I don't want to give too much away because it's a little plotty.
I'm sensing that comparison to the Taxi Driver. To the Taxi Driver. Robert De Niro is the Taxi Driver.
Oh, well, mate. Are you the Taxi Driver? Oh, it's Hal. Hi, Hal.
Hi. What are you doing back there,
to the space station, mate?
That's the only time these movies would be compared.
Yes. Taxi Driver 2001 and The Equalizer. The classic triple bill.
At the end of the movie, Denzel becomes a star child and saves Chloe Grace Moretz.
Yeah, well, you say that, but he sort of does. Chloe Grace Moretz's character, if you're a Chloe Grace Moretz fan, should point out that she kind of abruptly disappears from the film. But she's the kind of the training wheels that Denzel takes off to become what he was before, a violent reprisalist. He is the Equalizer. He's tougher than the reprisalizer. Martin Shawkus is kind of a special ops Reese Shearsmith in this movie. I couldn't get Reese Shearsmith out of my mind watching him, but I really liked him. He's got this kind of gluey charisma, and he and Denzel together are very, very watchable.
Right.
They are the twin kind of pillars that keep this from being ridiculous.
Mm.
So I watched it and I quite enjoyed it. We gave it 3 stars. I would go along with that. But 2 weeks later, it's Edward Woodward in a puddle next to a car in my mind.
But at the same time, it's got a gardening center, special ops Reese Shearsmith. It's hard not to make a case for this being the greatest movie ever made.
Yeah, it's got Yeah, well, I'd like to think I've tried.
All right,
but,
three stars. Three
it's
stars.
Just over 2 hours of mindless Friday night nonsense. Three stars worth, I would say. I think other reviewers are going to be pretty hard on it, but actually, it has some pleasures, and I think Denzel is very, very watchable, always.
Absolutely. Three stars in for The Equalizer, which, as we always say in the podcast, is a recommendation. Up next is Maps to the Stars, which is the new David Cronenberg film. It's part Hollywood satire, it's part psychodrama, in which an all-star cast, including John Cusack, Julianne Moore, Robert Pattinson, and Mia Wasikowska, negotiate the perils and pitfalls of Tinseltown. Phil, I'm going to come to you again.
Yeah, please do.
I will.
Love that. Yeah. Well, I really like David Cronenberg. I came to him a little late because I didn't really experience his, probably as you did, Chris, his body horror phase first at the time.
Yeah, but I'm one of those guys who's going, why don't you make the old gory stuff again?
He's gone, it's sort of body horror of the mind, really. There's a sort of weird ickiness to his recent films, excluding, say, A Dangerous Method. And I think this is his best since probably A History of Violence. It's very funny. It's a comedy, but it's not a kind of a laugh out loud comedy. But there's something about Cronenberg. He brings the humour in really weird, perverse, backdoor kind of ways. He's at pains to say this isn't supposed to be The Player. It's not supposed to be a straight Hollywood satire, but it is obviously set in Hollywood. It follows a Hollywood family, the Weisses, whatever you want to call them. And the clan involves John Cusack, who's kind of a life guru, his wife, who is played by Olivia Williams, ex of this podcast, and their son, Benji Weiss, who's played by Evan Bird, who's a newcomer to me, and really, really fantastic in a kind of a Justin Bieber-y, brattish kind of child star.
Yeah.
But the standout in this film is Julianne Moore, who's, I think, getting better and better with each year that goes by and each role that goes by. She's a kind of a Betty Davis type character. This film is sort of the exact midway point between what happened to Baby Jane and Entourage, I would say. There's lots of really funny, really dark stuff in it. It's a ghost story, I think, is what Cronenberg and Bruce Wagner, the writer and novelist, wanted to bring to this, is that this idea of the past catching up with Julianne Moore's character. Her mother died in a fire. She was a movie star. Julianne Moore wants to play the part her mother made famous in a remake of this movie from the black and white era. So it cuts back and forth across those sort of ghostly remembrances of the past. And I really liked it. We gave it 4 stars. Again, it's Cronenberg. Not everyone's going to like it. It's like a big pot of Marmite with a fly in it.
It's like all Cronenberg films, a bit cold, a bit detached. You get a sense that they're not so much characters as viruses in a petri dish, and he's a scientist studying them from afar. Having said that, I think it's a return to form for him. I was very cold in A Dangerous Method. I loathed Cosmopolis, which is unusual for me with Cronenberg.
Unfair.
I really did. But this is very, very good. I really enjoyed this one.
Yes, I agree. I think that's a really good analogy. There is a detachment. I don't think he's not someone that doesn't care about his characters, but yeah, they're sort of, sometimes they're ciphers for other ideas, perhaps, should we say. And you're right, you don't go and watch a Cronenberg film for the
lols.
Yeah, I was going to say the kind of Richard Curtis warm and fuzzies, because that's not going to be your great first date movie, I wouldn't have said, but it might be a great 10th date movie with someone with an equally twisted sense of humour.
That's a good performance as well. Robert Pattinson's on the periphery of the action. He's good. Yeah, he's good. But I think this movie belongs as much. We haven't really mentioned Mia Wasikowska, who plays. It's hard to really talk about her character without giving too much away. But she's very, very good as a damaged young soul who comes to Hollywood looking for payback, shall we say? I think that's fair to say. Cusack's good, but yeah, it's Julianne Moore's film. There's been talk of a Best Actress campaign around her for this movie, and she's very good. You know,
I hope if she does win the Best Actress, and they show the clip before when they announce the nominations on the night, they show the clip of her on the loo, acting, to perform in the scene whilst farting, just in the midst of all of the really emotional kind of like clip sequence. That would be a Cronenberg-y touch for the night.
4 stars then for Maps to the Stars. So Maps to the Stars may well be Film of the Week, but I think it's going to fie for that title with Pavel Pavlikovsky's latest, which is Ida. Phil, again, you've seen this one.
Yeah, it'll vie for screens with that film, certainly, because it will probably appeal to a similar sort of audience.
Yeah.
Again, not going to be everyone's cup of tea. It's a Polish
film in black and white, set in the 60s, the communist era. We often sit here and talk about films failing the Bechdel test. This film gets, I would say, 100%. It's got two great female characters, Anna, who is a very young nun, who is basically instructed to go and meet her relative, Wanda. Wanda used to be quite senior in the sort of communist apparatus, is now kind of fallen on harder times. She is a great, great character. She's salty, she's funny, she drinks heavily, she says ridiculous, outrageous things, she doesn't give a shit. It's a kind of, if you can imagine Bellatar's Scent of a Woman, that's what this film is. The two of them go the two of them go on a road trip and find out basically about Ida's parents and her history in the war. She turns out she's actually, sorry, Anna, rather, the nun, turns out that she's actually called Ida. She's of Jewish heritage. Her parents, she discovers their fate from the Holocaust in Wanda's company, and also finds out a lot of things about herself and about life in the course of what's actually a fairly economically timed but considerately paced movie. It's not a fast pace. He does a lot of language shots. The photography's beautiful. And two great performances. I want to name check them, but it's too early in the morning to get my mouth around a word that begins in TRZ. Agata Trzebukowska, I think, is the name of the girl who plays, the woman who plays Anna.
Sounds good to me.
And Agata Koleshka is probably not how you pronounce the woman who plays Wanda. And the two of them are both great, and I really enjoy this movie. 4 stars.
If you are of Polish extraction, I apologise. We'd like to apologise for trampling over the pronunciation there. Please do send us in the correct pronunciation of those names. But 4 stars, yes, for Ida. Pawlikowski is fantastic.
Yeah, it's his best. I mean, he introduced
best.
Emily. No, I was going to say his best since probably, I don't know, well, certainly for a long time. He tragically, his wife died not that long ago, and he made Woman in the Fourth with Kristen Scott Thomas in Paris, which is not his finest moment. Mm. But he introduced Emily Blunt in My Summer of Love a few years ago and caught the eye with that. And I think this one is going to, it just feels like his, you know, he's found himself again as a filmmaker.
Okay, let's move on to the last one we're going to dissect in some depth this week, which is It's What We Did on Our Holiday, which stars the last of this week's guests. Do stay tuned for Rosamund Pike, along with David Tennant and Billy Connolly. Hell's
yeah,
bells.
Yeah, that's right. So this comes from the guys who wrote Outnumbered, Guy Jenkin and Andy Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And so you won't be surprised to know it sort of shares a little bit of kind of that tone. It shares a little bit of that sort of a similar setup, I guess. So it's a comedy about a family. Pike and Tennant play a couple who are on the verge of splitting up. We are told by one of their children that daddy had an affair with a Paralympic athlete with one foot, or words to that effect. But they nevertheless decide to put a brave face on it and take the three kids up to granddad's birthday, granddad being played by Billy Connolly. It's his 75th. The other son is planning a big do, mostly for his own ends rather than his father's, who couldn't care less. So there's a lot of family politics going on there. And then things happen that mean the kids spend a lot of time with their ailing grandfather. So there are a lot of laughs here. There's a lot of quite sweet comedy. The kids are generally pretty good, although you can kind of tell sometimes that they were told to improvise while the adults are very much sticking to a script. You know, there's little bits of tonal shift.
That's very much the Outnumbered model, isn't it?
I guess it is, yeah. So maybe that's why. But it's, you know, it has moments where it works brilliantly and moments where it's less successful, I think it's fair to say. And there are plot developments, I'm not going to go into too much, that sit very oddly with that setup. There are moments this film goes in a direction that you maybe will not expect from the way it's framed, and that doesn't sit terribly well. So it kind of brings it back to something slightly warmer and fuzzier for the ending, but given what's happened in the middle, that feels a little odd. So anyway, we give it 3 stars. Lots of good stuff, but maybe not quite a home run.
Indeed, 3 stars then for What We Did on Our Holiday. Honourable mention should go to I, Origins, which is the latest from Mike Cahill and Britt Marling, and stars Michael Pitt. It's a very, very touching romantic drama with big, big sci-fi ideas. I'm not sure how many cinemas that's going to be in, but we gave it 4 stars. So do check it out, especially if you liked Another Earth.
Yeah, his previous one.
Same sort of emotional reach and big, big ideas. So do check that one out as well. And also out this week is the British horror Honeymoon, which got 3 stars. So if you fancy a bit of a scare, It's got some for you, so go and check that out as well. Now, normally, this is the part where I say, and that's it for this week's Emperor Podcast. Join us next week for more of them. But not this week, because this week we have a third guest. She is the star, as we were just saying, of What We Did on Our Holiday, but she's also the title character in David Fincher's Gone Girl, which is out next week.
She doesn't play Gone Girl.
She doesn't play Gone Girl. It's not a superhero thing. You know, she's Amy Dunn in that movie, which is out next week, October 3rd. And that's the juiciest role of her career to date, which is no mean feat, given that she burst onto her screens as a Bond girl slash villain in Die Another Day and has, along the way, accrued the likes of The World's End. And yes, Jack Reacher. We don't just throw this shit together. We can't do. On her CV, she is, of course, Rosamund Pike. And she was talking to Helen and Dan.
Just before we start with Rosamund Pike, we should possibly make a couple of things clear. First of all, if any of you know Gone Girl, you will know that she is the person who goes missing, and that, you know, she appears in flashbacks and so on through the story, but you may not want to know anything more than that. And if that's the case, you probably want to skip the next 9.5 minutes of the podcast, come back to it once you've seen Gone Girl. If you've read the book, you can safely, obviously, keep listening. If you're spoiler sensitive, I'd maybe just be a little bit careful, because Amy Dunn is a complicated character and Rosamund Pike does deal with some of that complication, so you may not want to know what she has to tell you. Otherwise, enjoy.
Rosamund Pike, hi, welcome to the Emperor Podcast. With Gone Girl, we've been hearing from David already that people are sort of divided when they're watching it into Team Nick and Team Amy. Are you then the headmistress or the captain of Team Amy?
Well, somebody else told me this in an interview this morning. They said, "Oh, it's been, you know, the bloggers. There's the presence of Team Nick and Team Amy is very present on the web." You just don't think like that when you're making a film or playing a character. It's like someone asking you whether you like your character. I think once you reach the point of understanding your character, it sort of goes beyond like or dislike. You know, I think understanding sort of it's just something different. It's you don't really analyze beyond that. You just know who they are and you're sort of with them. You go with them. Sometimes playing Amy made me feel uncomfortable. Sometimes it was exhilarating.
Yeah.
That was the joy of it.
I just find it fascinating that we could be in any way comparing Gone Girl to, you know, Twilight or something with its team Edward and team Jacob. You know, something.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. But I mean, anything that gets people, you know, talking is good. I mean, there's a sort of clear, again, a stake driven through the audience. You know, yeah. I think, you know, women sort of sit back, men sort of crane forward. And, you know, that's another point. I mean, David in his films is divisive in nature. I think that's the genius of his films. He's provocative and he never lets you sort of rest easy in what you're supposed to be thinking. Yeah. Because ultimately, of course, there's nothing you're supposed to be thinking. He just wants you to go on a ride. So, you know, people would come to set and would say to him, "Oh, I've seen the dailies, they're really funny." To be met with total silence from Mr. Fincher. And then they say, "Well, they were supposed to be funny, weren't they?" Total silence from Mr. Fincher. So, you know, he just loves to let people sort of squirm in a stew of their own making. And you sort of see it again and again. You just can't win. He'll always, whatever you say, he'll turn it on its head. You know, if I said, you know, I like the film, or eventually when I kind of came around and said, I think I like it, he said, "Well, we know you need therapy." You know, that's probably everybody else will think after they've seen the film as well.
Well, you mentioned actually just now understanding Amy.
Yes.
Can you? Really?
I can, I think. Wow. Yeah. I think I can understand her. I mean, I think that's what's exciting. You know, that's what, you know, I was speaking to a friend and I said, what do I say when people say, how do you play Amy? And they said, oh, just tell them you phoned it in. So I said, if I have the balls, I'll do that in New York. I'll just, on a talk show, I'll just let everyone guess. But I think you know, as an actor, if you're willing to sort of go one place, why aren't you willing to go another place? You know, if you're willing to sort of let your romantic side out there, and, you know, why can't you let your sort of, you know, more toxic, rageful side out there as well? I mean, that's sort of part of the job, I think. It doesn't mean that that's who you are at that moment. It just means that, you know, your whole panoply of emotions that you've had since you were sort of birthed to whatever age you are now, it's all there for the taking if you want to take it. And then it's never, you know, you very rarely get to sort of play something and put it into the same situation as you experience in your real life. Yeah. But you can sort of take a feeling and, you know, push it through another gate, as it were.
It's funny because there's the section in the book that I think everybody connects with to Amy, which is the sort of the cool girl description, where she talks about she's a cool girl and what that is. And that's something that I've seen lots of blogs written about that section in the book. It's only about a paragraph, I think. But, you know, people really connect with that. And then I think people stay connected to her for a longer time than they're probably comfortable with.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. I was teasing the MTV interviewer who came to interview me today because she was dressed this way. I said, "Oh," I said, "it's very cool." I said, "Are you a cool girl?" And she said, "Well, that's what I thought when I, read the book." I was like, "Is this what I do? Do I just pretend to be someone else for a living?" And then she's like, "Maybe I do." And I think, you know, that we live in this culture right now that is encouraging us to sort of try on, you know, to shapeshift and try on different personalities. You know, we're invited to edit our lives, to incite the envy of others on Facebook and make our lives look cooler and, you know, more filled with, you know, the best nights out ever than everybody else's. And it's into that sort of climate that Gillian Flynn puts Nick and Amy's relationship. You know, they meet in New York, they meet at a hipster party downtown. I mean, Amy's not a hipster, and she's able to perform that if the situation demands it. And so in that respect, Amy's an actress, and then that becomes very interesting for an actress to play. You know, she's able to... And there's, you know, and Gillian's clever, because when she articulates this idea of the cool girl, the way that... You know, there's no such thing as, there's no defining character for a cool girl. She is whoever a certain man needs her to be.
Yeah.
You know, if he's a hipster artist, then, you know, she'll love sort of drinking, you know, rare batch sort of beers and going to sort of out of the way shows in
warehouses.
Sort of disused warehouses. Yeah. And if she's, you know, if he's a petrol head, you know, she'll suddenly get into vintage cars or whatever. But Gillian also points out that that can be fun, and there's no way that that's in itself sinister. It's perhaps dishonest, but is dishonesty in flirtation and such a bad thing? But obviously, in the case of Nick and Amy, it's you're dealing also with two very narcissistic personalities who have sort of high expectations, I suppose, and when those expectations are not met, then things start to go wrong. You know, the relationship's good as long as everyone's doing their playing their part.
And how was Ben then to collaborate with on this? Because you have some interesting scenes together.
Yeah, we do. Perfect narcissistic male. No, he's not at all. I mean, the interesting thing about Ben is he's having this sort of amazing moment where he's, you know, you're around that confidence that's coming from him sort of riding this wave of his career you know, both as a director and an actor, but there's no arrogance going with it. He's incredibly likable and very funny. You probably met him. He is very funny. And I think perhaps the public imagination doesn't accommodate very, very funny Ben Affleck. They don't really know about that because he hasn't really got to be that funny in his films, I don't think. And he is. His impressions are just, you know, he'd start sort of doing an impression of you within sort of minutes of meeting you. It's very good. And I think, you know, he has a very wry sense of who he is and what his position is in the film industry and in the media. And so to play a character who is besieged by the media and, you know, tossed and turned and sort of liked, disliked, loved, loathed, he's got some stuff to draw on in his own life. And I think he kind of relished that, actually, or at least was prepared to open that up.
Yeah. Are you looking forward to seeing him as Batman then?
Well, I sort of felt he was becoming Batman. I mean, do you not see how he sort of started to burst out of his shirt?
Yeah, by the end of the film? It was just me. I just thought, is he or not? Okay.
I think I sort of saw him sort of morphing into Batman as we carried on filming.
But he's got a villainous chin.
A villainous chin, indeed. So, I mean, he's got the perfect, the killer smile and the villainous chin. Villainous chin, it's quite hard to say. Yeah. He has got the perfect face for Nick Dunn. I mean, I suppose a good actor has a face that can sort of, you know, be morphed into, and you can say, oh yes, well, it's the perfect face for that, and then it's suddenly the perfect face for something completely different. I'm very intrigued to see Batman, see his Batman when it comes out.
So were there a lot of funny people then on set, sort of, you know, because it's
well
not,
with Neil and Tyler Perry and,
you know, Neil Patrick Harris especially,
but I think these guys were relishing the chance of not to be funny. I think sometimes, you know, it's just like when I did Hector in the Search for Happiness with Simon Pegg, and I think he, you know, he sort of relished the chance not to have to be funny. Mm. And it's always hard to convince an audience that that's a good idea, because, you know, when they've sort of become so used to seeing you be, you know, make them laugh, and they sort of feel you're there and you will guarantee them laughs, then they're a bit indignant when you don't. Mm. I mean, God, Tyler Perry and Neil were so damn professional. They were just... Neil was one of the loveliest people I've ever had the chance to work with. We had a really, really good time. You know, the technicality involved in shooting some of those scenes, there's a lot of preparation goes into it. And, you know, we were under time pressure on the day. We had to make sure everything went like clockwork for reasons that will become apparent. And so Neil and I, when we figured out what we were going to do, and obviously, you know, when you know you're probably in an R-rated movie, you've got the sort of, you know, the naughty compulsion to see how corrupt and strange you can sort of make things. And then David left us alone to rehearse it, just to make sure that we had everything sort of under control. And
Rosamund Pike, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Luke Evans, star of Dracula Untold.
No, no.
Okay.
Less and less.
Yeah, well, all right. And Sam Neill. Sam Neill, who will be here talking about the return of Peaky Blinders. And yes, Event Horizon. Do you say? I wasn't around for the interview. I was so gutted.
I know.
So gutted not to be here. The great Dr. William Weir was in this very chair.
But at least you'll be able to do your Northern Irish voice when he's on, because he was, of course, born into Rome.
He was indeed born in Omagh.
Yes.
A very first interview I ever did for Empire Magazine was Sam Neill.
Oh, it was good, so way lovely. To start. It's all been downhill from there.
It has all been downhill. I said to him at the end, I said, Sam, I'm just curious to know whether you get back to Northern Ireland, you know, what, you know. No, not really. Okay, great. No, he's a lovely guy. Lovely guy. It was a fantastic experience. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
I'm off to lobby hard for Jason Orange to join our pod team. I think he'd bring something invaluable to it. I'm not quite sure what, but it'll be fun finding out. You're always welcome here, Jason. See you next week. Bye-bye.